Space Oddity.
Hello to the listeners of the CRC podcast Space Oddity. Today I'm joined by Janine Teichert, a visiting researcher at the CRC. She's a postdoctoral research associate at the Department of Media Studies at Paderborn University in Germany and researches how people maintain and negotiate their social relationships via communication, media, and face-to-face interactions. Her postdoc project analyzes digital homemaking practices and refugees in hybrid spaces. I am Zoe Perko, a research associate in the project Borders of the World of the CRC, and in my work I focus on regional free movement and regional integration processes such as in the EU. Today I will be speaking with Janine about her research project, which focuses on the use of digital media by Ukrainians who fled their country amidst a full-scale invasion by Russia in 2022. Thank you so much for joining me today. So yeah, first, could you tell us a little bit more about your research project? What are you researching? What are you doing? And how does it relate to space?
Okay, thanks for having me, first of all. And thank you for the opportunity to being here in the CRC. It's my third week and the end of my research day. And it has been a fantastic time. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. So what I am researching, I am from communication and media studies. So my focus is always on communication and how people interact with each other. Applied to my current research project on Ukrainian refugees in Germany, I am trying to figure out how they're finding a new home or a digital home. I call it digital homemaking practices, referring to how digital, physical, and hybrid places are merging, and how Ukrainian refugees, particularly negotiating homes and homemaking processes. Since you can imagine that Ukrainian refugees are in a very difficult position currently, they have the opportunity to shuttle between Germany and Ukraine, which is a unique feature for the Ukrainian refugees in comparison to many other asylum seekers. But the physical homes in Ukraine are, in many cases, unlivable or in unlivable conditions. The houses are destroyed, the infrastructure is destroyed for many people who have been affected by the Russian attack on Ukraine. And in Germany, on the other hand, they get social welfare for some time and they have the opportunity to stay in Germany on a temporary basis. So it's also very difficult for them to have future prospects about finding a home in Germany or in another country of the European Union, since the European Union enacted the Temporary Protection Directive that is only allowing the Ukrainian residents, refugees, to reside in a European country for temporary time. And particularly in Germany, this has been renewed every year. So on a yearly basis, the government decides if the refugees can stay for another year or not. And as you can imagine, it's difficult to find yourself a new home when you don't know if you can stay in a country and you don't know whether you can go back to your home country, because the war is still ongoing at the time being. And they're kind of in a colleague called it a limbo, and I think it's a very nice way of describing it. So they find themselves in a limbo situation. And what I'm trying to figure is how digital media is coming in to maybe help them to negotiate home, or a digital home, or physical or hybrid home. This is still in the make. It's an ongoing research project. That's what I'm currently working on.
In that regard, you've coined the term Pendelflucht or shuttle refuge in English, which I found a very nice term also coming from migration studies. So you already spoke about this limbo. Maybe in a very specific, concrete terms, what does this shuttle refuge, how does it influence homemaking processes of Ukrainians in Germany?
And that's a very interesting question. So if you imagine that you are a refugee coming from a country that has been affected by war and you apply for asylum in another country, it's kind of obvious that you cannot go back to your home country, because if there's an ongoing war, then there's no reason to go back and to apply for refuge in another country. For the Ukrainian refugees, interestingly, the European Union has this Temporary Protection Directive that allows them to go back to Ukraine, although there is a war ongoing for now more than 2 years. And that creates a very specific situation that is particular for currently Ukrainian refugees, and we don't know how this is affecting future refugees. It might be the case that the European Union decides on similar cases in a few years from now, if there's another, let's say, influx of refugees coming to the European Union. But for now, this is particular for Ukrainian refugees. So they have the opportunity, although they are considered refugees in the European Union, to go back to Ukraine for some time. So maybe for a week or for two, to check on the situation, on the family members mostly. So they go back to see how is my family members? How are they? How's my house? Is it still intact? How is the city where I grew up, where I lived for maybe most of my life? And of course, it's very emotional, but it's also enabling them to do this, what I call shelter refuge, to go back in between Germany and Ukraine for some time. And there's a lot of border crossings, but I don't think there is an accurate number now of people who cross borders to check on the family members, on their homes, in the situation in the past 2 years. There might be some statistic, I haven't come across any yet. It would be very interesting to see if it's the same people that going many times, or if it's on a one-time basis for the vast majority of the Ukrainian refugees. But the interesting fact about this, this is a feature that wasn't possible in migration law in a long time up to now. And this is why I coined the term shuttle refuge, because it's kind of a shuttling between two countries. And we have to keep in mind there is a war still ongoing. So depending on where they go, even in the places that haven't been totally occupied by Russia, it's still dangerous. There can still be missile attacks. There can still be bomb alarms. People might have to seek shelter in metro stations or in places in the city. And one of my interviewees told me that she was, let's say, visiting, like she was shuttling back to Ukraine. And by the time that she was there, there was a bomb alarm. And then she felt totally afraid and didn't know what to do, because she has been a refugee in Germany for almost a year. And then going back to Ukraine and then not knowing how to cope with the situation, because you're not affected by this anymore since you left since the beginning of the war. And then she said that she just followed everyone else, and everyone else was very calm. And this is like on a daily basis. This is for us living in a safe environment. This is kind of unimaginable there's a bomb alarm, and then, yes, everyone else is doing their daily business. They just, they remain calm, and they just, maybe seek shelter because they know they have some time until there might be something coming. And then she said it was helping them to perceiving the other people, their fellow citizens, for the short time that she has been back to Ukraine, and perceiving them as very calm and relaxed. She felt more secure, although there was an ongoing bomb alarm in a war zone country. And she said it was a very interesting experience for her, because she didn't expect this feeling and how to deal with the situation, because she hasn't been in the country since she left. And so the shuttle refuge is a very specific moment in time, I would say, and also in migration law for the time being. And we don't know how this is affecting future political decisions and future cases of refugees. But for now, it's more or less a unique feature, although we have seen similar events in the 1990s with the war in Bosnia and people fleeing from there and migrating. There was a similar part of the temporary protection status, I think it was called back then, but it's a long time ago. And for now, for the environment that we're living in concern of digitalization, mediatization, a lot of things have taken place in the meantime. So digital media comes into the picture that has been in a different way in the 1990s.
Thank you very much. I found it very interesting, the fact that this person went back to Ukraine, to the place where they're from, and then didn't really know the codes or yeah. how the practices, the common practices of the place they're from. Do you know how it affected their sense of home in that matter? I mean, did they feel then maybe foreign, or would you say, where is the home of Ukrainians right now?
That is a very good question, and I'm afraid I cannot answer in one sentence. I think it helped them to feel more at home, observing and perceiving how her fellow citizens in that situation reacted. I think she felt foreign in that particular moment, being away from her home country for such a long time and then perceiving herself in a situation, not knowing what to do. I think there was a moment which you can consider as being a foreigner in your own country. But then after she followed what everyone else was doing, I think she felt more secure and more safe and more like at home, because she has the fellow people or fellow citizens to guide her along the process.
So for people who don't specifically work on home and homemaking, from your perspective, what is home? What are specifically homemaking practices?
Well, there's different perceptions in research, depending on which discipline you're looking at, of course. I think home can be a lot of things. If you ask architects, they will probably say home is the physical house that you live in, that you maybe built yourself or had an idea of how you want to structure it, with all the interior, with all the furniture, with all the personal items that you bring along, particularly when you move and you think about what you want to take and what you want to drop or to throw away. I think that would be an answer from a physical perspective, to perceive a house as something that is part of your identity also, or it helps you to form your identity. In other disciplines, I'd say, especially in digital media, home can be much more non-haptical. So it's a lot of interpersonal negotiations where you find home is maybe, as the CRC would call it, the networks, the people that stay in touch with each other, and then they create places by communicating with each other. So that can also be home if you connect home with the people, with relatives, with friends, with the people that are close to you, with social ties. Other disciplines would say home is it's undefinable because it's such a fluid and abstract concept that you cannot grasp it. It's a very broad definition to find home. I think in my opinion and my consideration of what I perceive as home, it's a mixture of all these different things, and this is where space comes in. So if you define home as well as physical and digital and maybe hybrid, then home becomes an entity of a lot of things that can resemble places and spaces, but also people and connections and maybe even journeys when you move from one location to another location. And there's always networks that you keep and people that you will keep in your social network. And maybe you have a lot of homes because you have people in different places and different territories or different countries, and you will still say, maybe this is home where I grew up, where I was born and where I grew up. It might be even two different places, and then maybe you move on from there to another place and you stay for some time and you consider this home too. So you can have many homes in my understanding.
And in a context of forced displacement, how does this notion of home manifest? How does it play out?
That's a very interesting research subject that I still have to get my head around. I think especially for displaced people, it is not a decision to leave their physical home and their home country, because they most often don't have any other choice than to leave, to flee, to find safety for themselves and for their family members. So it's much more difficult for them to leave everything behind, because it's not a voluntary decision to move somewhere. And that's why I think it's also important for them to create this perception of safety and of welcoming. But this is especially difficult when you have a temporary visa or a temporary option to stay in a country, because this doesn't transport the feeling of you're welcome to stay. This is like, you can stay as long as the situation is dangerous for you, but it will be difficult to find home if you know that you have to leave in some point. If you... for example, if you think of exchange students, it's a similar effect for voluntary migration, if you want to look at it that way. As an exchange student, you know you're going back to your home country in a very definite period. So you stay for maybe a semester or maybe a year, but you wouldn't try to find yourself a home in that country where you go abroad, unless you really plan to stay there a long time, maybe during your stay or after the stay. But I think for many students, this is either an idea before they went abroad, because they look for countries specifically that they can imagine to stay long term, or they go particularly on exchange knowing that they will go back home. So they wouldn't try to find themselves a home when they're abroad, because it's only a very short time. And specifically for displaced people, the situation is similar, but much more difficult, because they didn't leave voluntarily. And even if they would like to stay, they don't know if they can stay. They have to find most likely work or some other kind of option, visa option to stay in a country where they move to involuntarily, when we're speaking of forced migration and displacement.
Yeah, I found this quite funny now that you spoke about this parallel to voluntary migration, because I came to Berlin thinking I'll stay 6 months, and now it's been 6.5 years, and I only a few weeks ago put my pictures on the wall, because before I didn't want to make holes in the wall because I thought I'll leave soon and then I'll have to make it better again before the landlords comes, etc. So I can relate to that, but of course my situation is very, very different. What are the main differences that you see in homemaking processes, or what would you think of, what are the differences of homemaking processes of Ukrainians compared to voluntary migrants?
I think it's similar to what you just pictured, because if you don't know that you're going to stay, you're not trying to find yourself a physical home. So what we can see from research, also the CRC has a sub-project that was working on how physical homes change when migrants come to stay. And then they would redecorate the house, and they would move furniture, and they would even plant gardens and something to make themselves home. So they would adapt everything in their physical surroundings to find themselves a new home. If you have the prospect of staying there for, let's say, longer than 6 months. For Ukrainian refugees, what we can see for now is the housing situation is much difficult, and also different to in comparison to the other refugees that have been coming to Germany beforehand. Particularly for Ukrainian refugees, what we can observe, a lot of people left their houses to make space for the Ukrainian refugees. So people voluntarily moved out of their home, going to some other place. Maybe they had a second residence somewhere to make space, or they moved together with a friend or partner to make space for Ukrainian refugees, so they didn't have to go to, not all of them, of course, I'm not trying to generalize, but for many people we know, it was possible to go into homes that have already been built as homes. A lot of other refugees, of course, had to go to emergency shelters, and we all know the pictures from these big halls with a lot of bunk beds that are not very cozy and they don't transport the feeling of home. So let's say for the Ukrainian refugees who were fortunate to live with relatives, with friends, to have people freeing their apartments or their houses to make space for them, the conception of home is different than the ones who had to go to these emergency shelters and the bunk beds. Particularly when you're traveling with family, with kids, you're trying to create something that is transports the feeling of home, because you want to make, the perception, especially for kids or for your family members, is if this is a safe place, keeping in mind that they just fled from an ongoing war. So this is different for a lot of refugees that came to Germany so far, that we haven't seen in such extent before. There was similar events before, but I think not to the amount as we can see now. But as usual, there's more research necessary in this regard, and we have to see how this is going on. I hope there is other researchers focusing on the homemaking of particularly Ukrainian refugees. So far, there is not much out there, as much as I know about it. Conclusions are limited to this point.
Yeah, thank you for already giving some insights. So you work on digital spaces. How does the use of digital media influence the sense of home of Ukrainian refugees?
Well, in media migration research, there is a long history of how digital media has been used for people moving abroad, voluntary and forced. Usually it's for keeping connections, because you always want to know how is the people left behind, how is the family members, how is the situation at home. So digital media facilitates a lot of these networking processes, I would say, because if you keep in mind that everything is so digitalized by now, the cost for telephoning in the 1990s was much higher from one country to another country. With the internet and the Wi-Fi connections in many places, it becomes much easier to catch signal and to keep in touch with people that you left behind. And of course, the people who couldn't go abroad or who couldn't flee, if we speak of forced migration, they also want to know how is the situation. And this is how you exchange information, not only on the well-being and the health conditions, but also which countries are safe places, which countries can we go to. For the people who successfully made it, they transport the information back and report home. Let's say, look, Germany is a good place for this and that. Poland is a good arrival station. You find information there and you have to do this and that. And there's a a lot of information that is so easily transported via digital media, because the vast majority of people fleeing and voluntary moving are using digital medias. And as we saw from previous research on refugee migration, many of them have mobile phones and mobile phone with internet connections. So the entire process has been accelerated at a much cheaper price than was decades ago. There's a lot of networking, but there's also a lot of information exchange happening via digital media that was, let's say, different 20, 30 years back in time. So I'd say it's a facilitator for moving voluntary and forced.
So it's mainly to stay in touch with your network, so connecting with your network and information sharing.
Not only, but also considering the homemaking processes, we still have to do more research on this. But I would assume that in the direction of homemaking, this will also facilitate the negotiations. What happens usually when you find a home abroad is that you want to keep the connection to the place where you come from, but you also want to make new connections when you're trying to socialize or to find, for instance, community. A lot of refugees will try to connect with their community members who are also in the same location. So this is also a facilitator for them. They find information there, but they also find new people, they find new networks, they find help if they need. It's a little bit of everything. Like digital media is the starting point, I think, from which we can think in much wider terms, and especially in terms of homemaking. We still have to define what's actually homemaking. But if homemaking in a new place is also connecting with new people that you haven't known before, finding a community abroad or forming a new diaspora abroad in a place that has not had so many people, then it can also be part of digital homemaking if you use digital media to start these processes.
Yes, thank you. Usually digital spaces are seen as a facilitator, but do you also observe maybe some conflicts, tension, or even risks in relation to the use of digital media?
As usual, everything comes at a price. My colleague Irina would have been the person to speak much more on this regard, since she's focusing on the dangers, particularly of digital media. So from drawing on my memory, she's working on a very interesting project of GPS locations of refugees and how that puts them in danger. And I think she can speak a lot more on this aspect. So from my perspective, there's always danger in interpersonal communication that is limiting the perception that you have. In digital communication, as we all know, it's not the same as face-to-face communication, because the haptical sphere is missing. You cannot reach out and touch somebody's arm, or you cannot transport emotions the same way with digital communication that you can in face-to-face communication. So there's a lot of things and fears missing in digital communication that I would consider is a risk in communicating digitally only. Also, since we know from previous research that digital communication is not taking place at the same extent as face-to-face communication. So there's particular things that people wouldn't discuss via digital communication. They would only wait until they see each other again, if it's very important subjects for them, or if it's very important negotiations that they have to deal with a particular person. But then let's assume the person lives in another country or is currently on refuge. It will be difficult. So what are the options? Either you transport this digitally by a phone call or a text message or a video chat, or you wait until you see each other again. And what happens in particularly in voluntary migration is that they actually wait until they see each other again. And it can be a very long time frame, up to 1 or 2 years, maybe up to 5 years. But the connection is so deep between the two people that they would take this, let's say, disadvantage until they see each other again in face-to-face communication, which I find particularly interesting. But if you want to frame it as a risk of digital communication, then I'd say it's the loss of things that you cannot transport via digital communication, particularly emotions, the haptical sphere, everything that is missing in digital communication, not to mention misinterpretations. And, there's a lot of, even with video chats, there's sometimes it's time delays, sometimes it's interruption of internet connection that will disrupt the perception of the communication that you have via digital media in comparison to face-to-face communication.
So you explore digital, physical, hybrid spaces. How do these spaces or dimensions interact with each other in your research context?
Let's say they merge, I'd say. You cannot have one without the other. Nowadays, it's very difficult to find places without any digital communication. I mean, we know of this digital detox movement, and there is hotels, for example, where you leave the phone, the laptop, and every other digital device that you have for, let's say, a weekend to take a break from digital communication. But this is only temporary. So if you look at it in the long term, there's not many people who voluntarily give up on the opportunities of digital communication. So what happens is you cannot really escape digital media and digital communication. On the other hand, we are always in somehow a physical environment. It's not possible to put yourself in like outer space and then, you know, you won't have the option to interact with each other. So what happens is, I say, it's a merging of these different spheres, the digital, the physical, and whatever hybrid is, they're playing nicely together. But you cannot have physical only unless you're really aiming for no digitalization in every aspect. Even if we, as we speak now, we have our phones somewhere nearby. I mean, they might be in our bags, but they're still there. So you're still in your mind and in your perception. You're still connected because, you know, if you have an emergency, I can always retrieve my phone. If somebody is calling to tell me, okay, something happened, I'm not completely cut off digital while we're here in a physical setting and we're speaking to each other on a face-to-face basis. And the hybrid environment is a very, very interesting concept that I found particularly challenging and interesting at the same time, as is discussed here in the CRC, because there's so many different definitions of what is actually hybrid and who is in the hybrid environment and who is in hybrid space and who is not. So I'm a bit careful to give a definition of this because I still have to find my own way after all this enlightening input that I received here.
Before getting back to the topic of your experiences at the CRC, I still have one question. I found it very interesting in your project the relation between space and security. Because, so you mentioned before, people go back and there is war, but they feel safe because it's a known environment. What maybe tendencies or patterns did you observe there? Which space gives security and how, or maybe which space is insecurity?
That's an interesting question. I would go back to the network terminology, I think. Drawing on media and communication research, and particularly interpersonal communication, I think it's people who provide security. If we perceive other people doing the same things as we do, it's easier for us to relate. It's easier for us to adapt to a new situation, and it's easier to get along without thinking what to do, how to do, when to do, and how to change behavior, for example. If we think of the war context in Ukraine and people perceiving safety by observing other people, then I think this is an interesting example to consider safety not in physical only environment, also in the terms of the networking. Because if people give the perception that everything is okay, and then if we put ourselves in the same situation and we think, okay, if everything is calm and secure and nobody is panicking and nobody is, you know, running around crazy, and then maybe this is a feeling of, I don't know, hybrid safety in an unsafe physical environment that is transported via networks, via people. It's a very preliminary answer.
So today is your last day at the CRC.
Unfortunately.
What have been your impressions of the fellowship, and maybe what is one memory or one thought that you'll take with you?
Oh, it's difficult to name just one. My head is full with ideas and inspirations. It has been a delightful 3 weeks and very inspirational talks. And I had a lot of very interesting conversations with many sub-projects, and I'm very thankful to have the opportunity to have been able to conduct this fellowship, but also to meet with all your colleagues at the CRC. And I think the most interesting aspect for me is the interdisciplinarity and how that actually works out in the CRC. I mean, if you, as I did, observe it from afar, I've been following the CSE for some time because I thought the interesting research questions that you analyze are related to my project. So I was interested in getting to know more about it. But then what was on my mind before I came here is, how does it actually work? I mean, the CSE is so interdisciplinary, speaking from architecture to sociology to urban planning to media and communication, and it seems to work somehow. And I was really interested in figuring out how that actually works. So I don't have an answer to that. But what I found very inspiring is that it does work. You never have the feeling of this is everything is happening in their own departments. It is actually interdisciplinary. And this is what I find most inspiring, that is all these different disciplines coming together, working under the same umbrella on the different sub-project, but it's highly inspiring and it's working. I will take this as a thought back to my home university and to see if we can maybe establish something very limited, interdisciplinary, but on a different scale, because it's not possible to set up this huge project as a CSE from out of nowhere. But the thought of interdisciplinarity is really something that I want to follow up on, because I think it's very interesting that is working in practice, and to be part of this and to get inspired by all these different conversations and all the sub-projects that I had been able to visit. Yeah, I cannot say it in a different way. It's one of the best experiences that I had so far, and everyone is so welcoming and so open to all my questions and to all my and how do you do this and how does that work? And I never had the experience that perceived as there's the communication and media researcher again asking these random questions that we don't know how to answer. I never had this experience, and I think this is one of the best part of the CSE.
Yeah, thank you so much for these insights. So maybe one last question. Now, with all the food for thought you got here, what questions are you gonna look closer at in the next few weeks? Or maybe what are open threads that you want to pursue in the next time?
I think I will follow up on the interplay of the digital, the hybrid, and the physical. I think this is one of the outputs that is still working in my head that I haven't thought so much about, because coming from digital communication and media studies, you don't take the physical so much into consideration. But here it is very present because of the disciplines of urban planning and architecture and urban sociology, even, who take the physical always into consideration in their research. And that is something I will be working on more in the next few weeks and maybe months.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.